This is The State of Things. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stacio. In Naomi Benaren's new novel, Running the Rift, a young Tutsi in Rwanda tries to escape his fate by using his feet. He's a champion runner, coming of age in an era when tensions between the Hutu and Tutsi tribes are reaching dangerous levels. The novel takes place on the precipice of the civil war and genocide that left up to 1 million Rwandans dead. Naomi is no stranger to Rwanda, nor to running. She works as an advocate for refugees and has worked with genocide survivor groups. And on the side, she's an Ironman triathlete. She talks about her new novel tonight at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill and tomorrow night at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. But first, she joins me in the studio. Naomi, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
The story of how this novel formed is a complicated one. Tell us about it.
It kind of happened in pieces. The first piece happened when I saw the 2000 Summer Olympics, and there was a wild card heat in the 100-meter freestyle in swimming, and this man from Equatorial Guinea who had never swam in a 25-yard pool, let alone a 50-meter pool, did this kind of wild card heat for people who would never qualify. Mm. And he swam, he was basically drowning for 100 meters, but he swam with so much heart, and he even did a flip turn at the 50-meter, at the side of the pool, and that just really stuck in my heart. I just had the vision in my head, and the story stuck in my heart. And then I went to Rwanda as a tourist in 2002. It was serendipitous. I went with my dog trainer because she had been invited to Rosamund Carr's 90th birthday. Rosamund Carr was an expat who spent most of her adult life in East Africa and mostly in Rwanda. And so I went with her, and I went as a tourist. We saw the gorillas, and I fell in love with the country when I first saw it. It was so beautiful and green. And the people, I knew a little bit about what had happened to them, and I was so struck by their openness and their willingness to take me into their homes and to talk to me. And then I was walking on the shores of Lake Kivu, which forms the western boundary of Rwanda, and it was a beautiful morning, and they have this rich, cool volcanic sand, and my foot hit something hard, and when I looked, it was a human bone. And I got down on my hands and knees, and there were bones everywhere. Mm. And I held them in my hands, and I had this sort of seminal moment when I realized that they weren't just bones, they were stories, and they were stories that would not be told unless someone gave them a voice. And that was the moment that the story was born in my heart as the story of Rwanda.
So briefly lay out for us just the plot of this novel and what happens.
Okay. Jean-Patrick Nhuba. Nhuba is the god of thunder. So Jean-Patrick has as his name this namesake who is swift and cunning and powerful. And he is at the start of the novel. It's 1984, so it's 10 years before the genocide. And, excuse me, he is 10 years old. And it's a period of relative peace. His father was a teacher at a secondary school called Gihundwe, and all Jean-Patrick wants to do, number one, he wants to be a teacher, he wants to study science like his father did, and he discovers early on that he has this talent and desire for running. So these two things form his character. They're like the flames that keep him going. And as the novel progresses, life becomes increasingly restrictive for Tutsi. So he is, in one sense, trying to run from this. He's not, doesn't consider himself a political person. He wants to avoid politics, but it becomes harder and harder to avoid politics. And then he falls in love with a beautiful, very political Hutu journalist who, and of course, that kind of puts politics in his face.
Is Jean-Patrick based on a real person?
He is based on a conglomeration of people. I have a close friend from Burundi. I'm also a massage therapist. And this runner, Patrick Nduimana, is an 800-meter runner who represented Burundi in the Olympics. So I learned a lot about the 800 from him. I personally hate the 800. I had a coach always used to make me run the 800, and I would throw up. But so a lot of that is Patrick, and then I had other friends who the way I write fiction is I graze. I suppose a lot of writers are like that. Mm. So I kind of just gathered all these stories and all these characteristics from people. And then he's a lot me too, like the competition, and I'm very familiar with that drive to succeed, both in science and in athletics.
Of course, because you have a background in science as well.
Yeah, I used to be a I guess I still am a geophysicist.
A woman of many talents. So I'd like to hear a bit of this. I'd love for you to do a reading, if you would. Would you set up the scene for us that we're about to hear?
Okay. This is a scene that takes place. It's between Jean-Patrick and his coach. His coach is Hutu, and his coach is at the secondary school where Jean-Patrick's father taught and where now Jean-Patrick goes. And they have just been to Kigali for a meet. And Jean-Patrick has just run a qualifying time for the Olympics in the 800s. So he's very jazzed about it. And now they're returning to Gihundwe. And they're in the car. And they've just gone through a checkpoint. This is during the civil war in Rwanda. And so there are checkpoints everywhere. And people have to present their cards. It's an identity card. The word in Kinyarwanda is Indangamuntu. So they've just been at this checkpoint. And in front of them was a Tutsi family that was hassled by the soldiers. And so Jean-Patrick also, he has blisters on his feet, which will become important at the end.
Okay. Naomi Benarin reading from Running the Rift.
I've talked to the burgomaster. An Olympic runner would be quite a feather in his cap. Tell me, how would you like to be one of the chosen? It was as if a book written in strange symbols had become suddenly clear. The photo before they left Gihundwe, the pointed questions and comments. Coach was offering him a Hutu card. He could barely take it in. But everyone knows I'm Tutsi, Jean-Patrick said. Coach waved the words away. It's not so difficult to invent a male Hutu relative somewhere in the past. Do you think it hasn't been done before? Jean-Patrick had heard the stories. I've accepted a position at National University, Coach continued. No one else in Rwanda can train you to reach your potential, so I want you to follow me there after you graduate. You'll come to train with me on weekends next year, too. A Hutu card would grease all the wheels. I'm going to the Olympics, Jean-Patrick said. Isn't that enough? Not so fast. You have to run an A-standard time on a sanctioned track with an approved timing system between January 1995 and the Games. And you have to make it past the National Olympic Committee, the sanctioning body of Rwanda. If they choose, they can bypass a Tutsi with an A time to pick one Hutu runner with a B time. Jean-Patrick sank back against the seat. He had assumed all he had to do was run fast and he would get to the Olympics. We can never forget where Tutsi, his mother had said. They were climbing again, papyrus and umunyege-nyege, giving way to pine and eucalyptus. Coach honked at a group of children pulling a calf up the road, and they scurried out of the way. Clouds sailed across the Bugesera, the hills stained with shadow. Whirlwinds of dust swirled in the valley. A truckload of boisterous soldiers passed them. Crowded together in the bed, they shouted and sang, rifles raised high. Coach smiled. Their team must have won, he said. For a moment his eyes followed the men, then he turned back to Jean-Patrick. Someday a Hutu card could be even more important than the Olympics. His smile had disappeared. Jean-Patrick watched an ochre funnel swallow the children and their calf. The dust had almost a human smell, like sweat and earth fermenting in folds of skin. There was something else, too, a suggestion of iron and rust, like the scent of dried blood that remained as a war wound on Jean-Patrick's Nikes.
That was Naomi Benarin reading from her novel Running the Rift. She'll be reading at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill tonight and Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tomorrow night. And in that reading, we hear from Jean-Patrick's coach, and he is a Hutu, and he has little sympathy for the Tutsis, but he has great love for Jean-Patrick. Tell us about him and what you're we're getting at through this character?
It's interesting because of all the characters in the book, the coach came to me fully formed. From the minute he first walked into the story, I knew all his complexity and I knew who he was. And he's very much a part of the Hutu upper class, and he very much believes in their dogma that the Hutu are on top and that the Tutsi are trying to take Rwanda away from the Hutu. But on the other hand, he does have a deep and true love and respect for Jean-Patrick. And there's something almost like a father and son in the way he feels for Jean-Patrick.
The book takes place in the years before and then into what we now know to have been this horrific civil war and genocide in Rwanda. And you said that you were not that familiar with that when you first visited Rwanda. Tell us about, getting familiar with that history and then eventually working with Rwandan genocide survivors.
I'm afraid I was one of those people who initially had just watched it on the television. And of course, I felt awful, but then it truthfully went out of my mind. And I think when I started to learn about Rwanda, it was something that I always felt guilty about. And it was something that I really felt I needed to make amends for. A lot of my mother's family was killed in the Holocaust. So it was a deeply personal story to me. And as I learned the story from people who had survived it, I made really good friends. They're now as dear to me as brothers and sisters. And the more I learned about it, the more it really broke my heart and the more I really felt it was a story that I had to tell.
I'm interested if, as a writer, of course, as a writer of fiction, you have to be true to your characters and to your craft. And I wonder if that sense of writing out of, at least partly out of a sense of guilt almost, ever conflicts with that. You feel that tension between, I suppose, history and art, if you will?
I think in a way it fuels it. What I had the most conflict with was the appropriation of another culture, particularly because I am, in a sense, in the role of the oppressor. So that has been a very difficult thing for me to deal with.
How do you tackle that?
I tackle it in several ways. I was always asking a lot of questions from my Rwandese friends. And I think I set as my goal that I would be honest, humble, and approach the subject with love and respect. And every time I would ask them, do you think it's okay what I'm doing, they would say, you need to tell this story. Because at present, their own voices are not heard in the West. So I feel like I'm kind of opening the way for their own. And they are just now, after coming out of the genocide, becoming capable of using their own voices and approaching a Western audience. So, and I'd like to, anything that I can do to make that easier, I would like to do.
What do they tell you in your work with the genocide survivors? Of course, now everyone in Rwanda is adapting and has been adapting over the last decade and a half or so to living with people who massacred their friends and family or living with people whom they once attacked. What do they tell you about how they're doing that?
I think it's kind of a double-edged sword from what I gather. And it's interesting because two articles about that came out at the same time. One was Philip Gurevich in The New Yorker, who spoke of reconciliation and spoke of the hope of Hutu and Tutsi living together. And he also wrote a story about Team Rwanda, which is a bicycle team started by an ex-cyclist called Jacques Boyer. And that is a very hopeful sign. It's young people, they're Hutu and they're Tutsi, and they're working together, and they have the bond of suffering through training together. So that gives me real hope. But the article that came out at the same time as Gurevich's first article is by this man called Jean Hatzfeld, and his books were very important to me. He wrote one called Machete Season, which was interviews with the people who committed genocide. And the other was Life Laid Bare, which is interviews with survivors. And his take was much less hopeful because he talked about now these genocidaires, as they're called, are being let out of prison and they're going back to the villages. And I think many of them, I think what it hinges on is asking for forgiveness. If they just come back to the village and don't accept what they've done and ask, approach their Tutsi neighbors and say, I'm sorry, forgive me, then it really increases the post-traumatic stress. You know, seeing these people who killed their families and who they saw kill their families walking down the street.
We've only got a minute left, but I want to end on a happier note and ask you, you're a triathlete.
Yes.
And obviously running the Rift focuses quite a bit on running. Why did you want that to be a thread in that, in this story, and how do those two things interact for you?
They're inseparable. Running and athleticism is so much a part of my being. You know, I wake up every morning and I train. Excuse me. I don't compete anymore because I've had some health problems, but training is essential to my life. And that was a bridge. It transcends culture. It was a way for me to get into someone who is a very different culture and to identify him and to have him in my heart and soul.
Well, Naomi, congratulations on the beautiful book. It's a winner of the Bellwether Prize for Fiction, and thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Naomi Benaren is the author of the novel Running the Rift. She'll be appearing tonight at 7 p.m. at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill, tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. That's the State of Things for today. The State of Things is produced by Alex Granados. Robin Copley is the technical director. The managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is the senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Stacio.